Battling violent storms, forest fire smoke, headwinds, and fatigue, a pair of Spokane, Washington aviators flew nonstop across America and back in 1929 to establish a new world record. Their Buell CA-6 sesquiplane, named Spokane Sun God, was the first airplane to make a nonstop transcontinental round-trip flight. Sponsored by the National Air Derby Association, along with Texaco, who supplied the gas, Buell Aircraft Company, who provided the plane, and many Spokane citizens and businessmen, pilot Nick Mamer and mechanic Art Walker took to the skies at 6 p.m. and headed west into the sunset from Phelps Field on August 15th as a crowd of thousands looked on. I'm Eric Ebel, your fearless field guide to Washington State history, heritage, and culture. And this is Washington, Our Home. Welcome back for another episode of the Washington, Our Home podcast. Before we begin, please leave me a 5-star review on your podcast app if you like the show. If you really want to help me keep making these, go check out how you can support the show over at patreon.com/washingtonourhome. There are 6 membership tiers you can choose from, and each comes with some pretty cool gifts for joining. Just head on over to patreon.com/washingtonourhome, and thanks for the consideration. Mamer and Walker's plan was fairly straightforward. Refueling planes would meet them at predetermined locations along the route, and the pair would drop notes to people on the ground or tied to the end of refueling hoses in order to communicate with tanker crews. Assuming good weather and a nice tailwind, they hoped their record-setting trip would go off like gangbusters. The first airborne transfer of fuel in the United States had come 8 years earlier, when stuntman Wesley May strapped a full can of gasoline to his back and stepped from the wing of one aircraft to another. On November 18, 1923, the U.S. Army managed to keep an aircraft aloft for more than 37 hours, thanks to aerial refueling. But those experiments ceased following a public demonstration of refueling, which ended badly. One man died. The receiving plane's propeller had sliced the hose dangling from the tanker aircraft, resulting in the fatal crash. In January 1929, a modified Fokker C-2 tri-motor, dubbed Question Mark, remained in the air for more than 150 hours. Question Mark's success sparked a frenzy of nearly 40 endurance flights in 1929 alone. Private pilots stretched the record for time aloft to over 170 hours, less than 6 months after Question Mark's flight. July witnessed the record extending to nearly 250 hours, and then to over 420 hours. Those feats demonstrated the reliability of state-of-the-art engine construction, as well as the utility of aerial refueling. Yet up to that point, endurance aircraft had circled above a small geographic area during their record attempts. The unspoken question was whether aerial refueling could enable a plane to fly nonstop over great distances along commercial air routes. A World War I aviator and experienced barnstormer, Nick Mamer, ran the premier flight school in Spokane. A pioneer of aviation applications for the U.S. Forest Service, he also operated an airline in the Pacific Northwest, Mamer Air Transport. Art Walker, a top-rated aircraft mechanic, worked for Mamer. Their flight had several sponsors, including the National Air Derby Association of Spokane, which had been responsible for bringing the national air races to Spokane in 1927. That group planned and coordinated preparations for the flight with Mamer and Walker, also serving as mission control during the attempt, coordinating refueling efforts and tracking their progress. Texas Oil Company, known as Texaco, provided the fuel, lubricating oil, and 2 refueling aircraft. The prominent Texaco Star logo adorned all of the aircraft involved in the attempt, including the additional refueling plane and crews Mamer provided. Buell Aircraft Company, that's B-U-E, H.L. of Marysville, Michigan, donated the air sedan Sesquiplane Spokane Sun God. In the days leading up to their flight, Mamer and Walker practiced with some of the crews. Air-to-air refueling in 1929 was a mixture of crude science and art. The tanker aircraft would fly in front of and above the receiving plane. A hose would then be dangled down from the tanker plane while the receiving craft positioned itself so as to place the end of the hose in the hands of a crew member in an open hatch. This carefully orchestrated aerial ballet at nearly 90 miles per hour required calm weather, good visibility, superb piloting skills, and a lot of luck. On one occasion, just days before the formal attempt, as Mamer eased the single-engine air sedan into position beneath the tanker aircraft, Walker reached up from his hatch on the plane's spine, grabbed the hose, and pulled it down into the cabin to begin the refueling process. Suddenly, Walker found himself hanging from the hose and nearly pulled from the plane before he instinctively released his grip and dropped back through the hatch. Only a split-second reaction had saved him from falling to his death over the hills of eastern Washington. The incident was a warning of the difficulties Mamer and Walker would face in their efforts to push the envelope of long-distance flight. Spokane's sun god emerged from its hangar at 2 p.m. on August 15th. Its brilliant red paint, resplendent white lettering, and prominent Texaco symbols glittering in the afternoon sun. Hundreds of cars lined the road south of the Spokane airfield as people streamed toward the plane and brightly decorated stand, complete with American flags and loudspeakers. Several officials gave brief speeches before Mamer and Walker appeared wearing sunglasses and street clothing. To one news reporter, the crewmen looked as if they were about to take an afternoon drive in an automobile. Neither man needed a bulky flight suit, since Sun God had an enclosed cabin, and the weather was warm. The two men squeezed into the cabin, where a custom-made 200-gallon fuel tank, supplementing wing tanks holding 120 gallons, replaced passenger seats in the middle of the cramped interior. Mamer occupied a small cockpit in front of the tank. Directly behind the tank was a space for a cot, as well as room for Walker to stand during refueling. A narrow passage between the tank and the side of the fuselage allowed the two men to trade places when necessary. The plane had a radio receiver capable of picking up weather reports on commercial broadcasts, but it lacked a two-way radio, because in 1929, radios were bulky and unreliable. In fact, Sun God's radio receiver proved to be unreliable too, as it ceased working only hours into the flight. Essentially a flying gas tank, Sun God was about 500 pounds overweight when Mamer opened the throttle on the air-cooled Wright Whirlwind engine, that's W-R-I-G-H-T. The Whirlwind had gained fame when an example powered Charles Lindbergh's Ryan NYP monoplane, Spirit of St. Louis, from New York to Paris in 1927. Like Lindbergh, Mamer appreciated the engine's rugged design, dependability, and good power-to-weight ratio. After a 4,000-foot takeoff run, which was shorter than many people expected, Mamer coaxed the plane into the sky while the crowd below cheered. Sun God flew southwest toward Portland through dense smoke from raging forest fires at the time. Over the Columbia River Gorge, the trusty Whirlwind sputtered and died. Mamer and Walker hastily donned their parachutes before they realized the cause of the problem. One of the gas tanks had gone dry. The flip of a switch quickly restored the engine's fuel supply, and both men breathed a sigh of relief when the deafening roar of the Whirlwind once again filled the cabin. Near Portland, they turned south towards San Francisco. Shortly after 1 a.m. over Northern California, the two aviators briefly became stuck, wedged together in the tight spot next to the oversized gas tank while attempting to change places. It was then they decided that the next time they exchanged positions, they would both remove their parachutes. Sun God arrived over San Francisco Bay at 3 a.m. on August 16th. but fog and darkness prevented the refueling plane from rendezvousing with them at the juncture. Mamer and Walker circled over Mines Field, snacking on nuts and drinking coffee, for hours until the tanker plane appeared after daybreak. After an uneventful refueling, Sun God headed east along the transcontinental airmail route bound for New York. The flight had gone well thus far, but many difficulties still lay ahead. Instead of catching an anticipated tailwind to push Sun God eastward, Mamer and Walker encountered a significant headwind as they flew toward their next scheduled refueling point, Cheyenne, Wyoming. Because the plane was consuming more gasoline than expected, they needed to refuel before they got to Cheyenne. Over Elko, Nevada, Mamer dropped a note requesting an emergency refueling at Rock Springs, Wyoming, about 300 miles west of Cheyenne. Members of Spokane's Air Derby Association ordered the refueling team in Cheyenne to meet the Sun God at Rock Springs. The two planes rendezvoused somewhere between 8,000 and 10,000 feet above sea level over Rock Springs as the sun dipped low on the western horizon, when Sun God had less than 30 minutes of fuel remaining. The thin air at that altitude restricted the tanker aircraft from bringing more than 100 gallons at one time to the air sedan. During the delicate high-altitude ballet, both planes narrowly escaped disaster when Sun God's propeller sliced through the swaying hose, spraying the air sedan with gasoline. Amazingly enough, sparks from the plane's exhaust did not ignite the flammable liquid blanketing the fuselage. After repairing what was left of the hose, only about 20 feet, and attaching a flashlight to its end, the refueling team once again joined the Sun God in the inky darkness above Wyoming. While the flashlight had seemed like a good idea on the ground, at altitude, its light blended in with the stars when viewed from below, and the refueling plane itself was equipped with only one exterior light. Relying on the two small lights dancing in the sky above his cockpit, Mamer had to use all his skills to stay in position. At one point, the two aircraft drifted so close together that Walker had to reach up while standing in his hatch and push the two planes apart. After three successful refueling forays, Mamer dropped a note over the Rock Springs airfield explaining he now had enough fuel to continue the flight eastward after sunrise. Over North Platte, Nebraska, and again over Cleveland, Sun God received more gasoline and oil, as well as watermelon, fried chicken, and also a bottle of eyewash that one man had requested. On Sunday afternoon, August 18th, the 10,000 spectators who had gathered to watch aerial spectacles at Roosevelt Field near New York City spotted Sun God approaching from the west. Mamer buzzed the airfield and dropped a letter from the mayor of San Francisco to his counterpart in New York. Under the leadership of the same aviators who had kept the St. Louis Robin refueled during its 420 hours of continuous flight in July of 1929, another flying tanker rendezvoused with the Sun God high above Long Island. They quickly replenished the air sedan's gas and oil, also delivering ice water, fried chicken, a cantaloupe, two apple pies, some tomatoes and cakes, and a gallon of ice cream. Stripped to the waist to cope with the heat, Mamer and Walker enjoyed their feast before beginning their flight back to the West Coast. By that time, they had spent more than 65 continuous hours in the air. Flashing navigation beacons kept the plane on course through the night sky over Pennsylvania. That night, over Bellefonte, Mamer dropped a note asking the airfield to flash its lights once for good weather, twice if marginal, and three times if bad. As Mamer and Walker looked on, the lights flashed three times, and within minutes, a storm hit. Sun God circled Bellefonte for 30 minutes in the storm until it became so fierce that Mamer decided to head west. He later recalled, "We dodged, detoured, and outrode one squall after another. Repeatedly, we tried to break through, but the storm was too tough and too expensive." Lightning bolts had struck all around the plane. More than once, the aviators considered bailing out, but they eventually pulled free of the storm, and they made it to Cleveland, where they refueled, and then flew to St. Paul as another refueling site, and then to Aberdeen, South Dakota, for their next tanker. They arrived over Miles City, Montana, not one of their predetermined refueling locations, just before 10 p.m. on August 19th, and Mamer dropped a note onto the airfield there, complaining about problems they were having due to smoke from forest fires. Quote, "Visibility is hellish tonight. Cannot see a thing on the ground such as contours, mountains," unquote. Mamer added that he and Walker were about to give up and land. In addition to the visibility problems, their navigation lights had stopped working. He requested that a large bonfire be lit in the middle of the airfield if the support staff believed they could refuel Sun God at daybreak. In the meantime, they would circle the airport until the plane ran out of gas. Peering through the hazy darkness, the pair soon spied the faint glow of a bonfire. As dawn broke over Miles City, a new J-5 Eagle Rock biplane laden with 8 5-gallon milk cans filled with gasoline took off to meet the weary flyers. While airport manager Frank Wiley piloted the refueling plane, local cowboy Tommy Matthews cinched a telephone lineman's belt around his waist. The belt was all that kept him from falling out of the cockpit as he slowly lowered a can of gas attached to the rope in his hands. Appearing to Wiley like a prairie dog in a helmet and goggles, Walker stood with arms outstretched in the Sun God's hatch, ready to receive the gasoline. By the time Walker emptied the first can into the Air Sedan's gas tank, Matthews had another full can ready. The cans repeatedly struck the Sun God's fuselage, but inflicted only minor damage. Within 25 minutes, all 8 gasoline cans were empty. The refueling operation had come none too soon. Their main tank had registered only 2 inches of fuel after circling Miles City all night. Wiley and Matthews delivered 2 more loads, both in less time than the first. After each of the 3 refueling operations, Mamer flew over the Yellowstone River, and Walker tossed the empty cans into the water, where a boy in a rowboat waited at the bridge in Miles City to fetch the cans as they floated by and returned them to the refueling crew. Sun God continued west through the smoke to Belgrade, Montana, where they refueled again before flying on to Missoula. 50 gallons of gas, some oil, and 6 chicken sandwiches later, Nick Mamer wearily pointed Sun God toward Spokane for the final leg of their journey. Five days after departing Spokane, the once bright red aircraft, now frayed and streaked with oil and airplane fuel, appeared over the city once again, just before 2 p.m. on August 20th. An estimated 10,000 spectators crowded the airfield to greet the returning heroes. Factory whistles sounded across the city, signaling the joyous news. Rather than immediately landing, however, the Sun God circled over Spokane for a few more hours, taking on more fuel and food. Mamer dropped a note requesting soap, water, clean clothes, but members of the Air Derby Association denied the request because they wanted the aviators to look disheveled at the conclusion of their flight. During an exchange of messages and fuel, Mamer Air Transport's Ford Tri-Motors brought up load after load of passengers, charging them $5 a person to observe Sun God in flight. Mamer, although bone-tired, was happy to stay in the air as his company raked in the spectators' cash. Mamer and Walker finally returned the wheels of the Spokane Sun God to the runway at Feltz Field after more than 115 hours of continuous flight. And while the time spent in the air was far from record-breaking, the Air Sedan had flown a lineal distance of 7,200 miles over some of the most diverse terrain in the United States to help establish a new world's record for the longest non-stop flight. Due to all the necessary detours, the actual distance flown was closer to 10,000 miles. The trip had also proved that air-to-air refueling was possible over established air routes. Capitalizing on the flight, Texaco planned to keep its air-to-air refueling operations fully equipped to continue in the business in case there is a demand for them. Mamer himself believed the demand for such operations would only grow, and outlined his vision that airports along established routes would soon boast refueling planes ready to serve transcontinental airliners. But that vision never materialized. Instead of inspiring others to employ aerial refueling, Sun God's experience served more as a deterrent. A series of accidents and later attempts by other companies confirmed the obvious perils of aerial refueling and compounded the public's perception that air travel was inherently unsafe. Moreover, aircraft manufacturers soon found other, much less dangerous ways to extend the range of their airliners. After their record-setting flight, Mamer and Walker remained in the aviation industry. Less than 10 years following his cross-country adventure, Mamer, who became a pilot for Northwest Airlines, was at the controls of a Lockheed 14 Super Electra over Montana in January 1938 when a structural failure due to a harmonic vibration tore the tail clean off his aircraft and brought down the plane, killing him, the co-pilot, and all 8 passengers. Walker, for his part, enjoyed a long career flying for airlines and corporations. He eventually served as director of aviation for Standard Oil Company, and in 1979 attended a Seattle celebration of the 50th anniversary of his 1929 Odyssey. Spokane Sun God's flight represented the apex of enthusiasm for the commercial use of air refueling. Less than a decade later, the endurance records of 1929 seemed strangely quaint, but the basic concept became important to military operations worldwide. During the tension-filled years of the Cold War, aerial refueling techniques made it possible for America to project its power around the globe. And today, U.S. military aircraft routinely fly combat missions requiring multiple air-to-air refuelings. Mamer and Walker's flight not only made history, but also led to the beginning of the Strategic Air Command program for the military. So, it's somewhat fitting that the Air Force's largest refueling station is based at Fairchild Air Force Base, just a few miles from where it all started. It's trivia time here on the Washington Our Home podcast. I'll ask 5 multiple choice questions about today's episode, and you remember your answers to the end of the episode when we find out who was right and who was lucky. Question 1 should be easy. What was the type of airplane that Mamer and Walker used to set the long-distance record in 1929? Your answers are A, a Fokker C-2. B, a J-5 Eagle Rock, C, a Lockheed 14, or D, a Buell CA-6. Question 2. Mamer and Walker set the non-stop distance record in 1929, but they weren't the first to successfully demonstrate that airplanes could be refueled in mid-flight. That honor went to stuntman Wesley May, who proved it could be done in 1921. How did he do it? Did he A, parachute onto the wing of a moving plane with a gas can strapped to his chest? Did he B, descend from another aircraft using a rope ladder and a portable gas can? Did he C, walk across the wing of his own aircraft to the wing of another with a gas can strapped on his back? Or D, he picked up full gas cans at 90 miles per hour while flying low across the ground. Question 3. Which of the following was not one of the food items delivered to Mamer and Walker in mid-air to keep them nourished on their record-breaking flight? A. Watermelon. B. Pie. C. Ice cream. Or D. Fettuccine Alfredo. It sounds pretty good about now. Question 4. What color was the Spokane Sun God? This one should be easy, I mentioned it at the beginning, and anyone passing through Spokane International Airport will have seen the giant mural. Your answers are A, red, B, blue, C, brown, or D, gray. Question 5, and this one's not so easy. Into which river did the Spokane sun god drop the empty milk cans that were used to refuel the plane over Montana? Was it A, the Missouri River, B, the Yellowstone River, C, the Clark Fork River, or D, the Flathead River? Remember your answers, and we'll see how well you've done at the end of this episode. Now, I have a special treat for you. I had the pleasure recently of interviewing a woman named Georgia Ferris, the granddaughter of Nick Mamer himself, along with executive director of the Spokane Valley Heritage Museum, Jane Singleton, not only a subject matter expert on Nick Mamer and the flight of the Spokane sun god, but the steward of an impressive collection of Mamer and sun god artifacts and historical materials. Thank you both for taking the time to speak with me today.
It is an honor and a pleasure.
Yes, it is.
Let's start first with you, Jane. I want to know about your history here in Spokane and how you came to be the director of the Spokane Valley Heritage Museum.
I started the museum in about 2000. There wasn't a museum for the Valley. There wasn't a repository. There wasn't anywhere where I could look at records, photographs, specifically telling the Valley's story. And interestingly enough, the Spokane Valley is where all the history in this entire region began. Long before Glover established Spokane, there was a house, a store, and a post office here in the Valley. And I thought, well, that story needs to be told, and so many other stories. So I just decided, you know, the Valley needs a museum, and I'm going to do it.
And you've told me before that the Spokane Valley Heritage Museum is not just the museum for Spokane Valley proper, but for the entire Spokane Valley topographical area.
Geographically speaking, yes. We cover actually much more than that. But we've grown so much, and our repository contains photos, manuscripts, diaries from all over the region.
And Georgia, you flew all the way down here from Alaska, where you currently reside, because you have family in the area.
Yes.
Because your daughter's here. And you've agreed to do this interview with me because you are the granddaughter of Nick Mamer.
Yes.
Tell me what stories you've heard while growing up about Nick.
The stories we heard were from my mother, but my mother was 10 when her dad died. But we do have a lot of paraphernalia from Nick. We have his watch. We have his pilot license. We have a lot of pictures. And so growing up, we used to go through the box that we have, and my mom would talk a little bit about her life growing up with him until she was 10 years old.
You mentioned to me earlier that she had a diary that she kept after Nick passed away, and you've been able to read through it.
Yes, I've read her diary. It's kind of sad. It's about a 10-year-old girl losing her father and how sad she was and how hard it was for she and her mother to survive after he died. They hired a bunch of attorneys to go after Northwest Airlines because of the tail falling off. And a couple of the attorneys passed away during the time. My grandmother became ill, and then they just forgot looking for restitution for them.
So they never were made whole?
No, they never were made whole.
Why don't we back up a little bit? And Jane, you can start by telling me what it is that Nick is famous for here in Spokane.
So many things. He flew over mountains before anyone else did, airmail. He started a flight school. He trained pilots at Phelps Field. Interestingly enough, the 141st located there in 1924. And Nick arrived right around that, a little bit before that time, actually. He was here, but he was training pilots out there to fly in these bicycle-looking affairs with wings on them that you look at now and you think, oh my God, what brave men.
Right.
Either courageous or just...
Crazy.
Crazy. And probably a mix of both. And then the 1927 air races. He flew also looking for fires.
Oh, fire spotting.
In Montana, too.
Idaho and Montana.
And
then, of course, the thing he's most known for is the 1929 flight of the Sun God. Pretty amazing pilot. Pretty amazing man.
Now, let's back up for a second, because you mentioned the 1927 air races. Was that something that started brand new in Spokane? Was that an annual event?
No, it was an annual event that was held in different cities. And the movers and shakers downtown, like Louis Wasmer and Victor Desert, decided, let's bring that here. It would be good for the economy. It would be good for putting Spokane on the map in terms of this new industry of aviation that was growing. And they were successful.
So much like Expo 74, a group of leaders got together and said, hey, let's bring this big event to our little city and get some exposure and show off some of our local pilots.
That's an interesting comparison and makes me stop and think about the vision for Expo and the vision for the 1927 air races, many, many years apart. Some things in common. And for me, I was actually going to make a judgment call in my mind, which was more of a vision, which did take more work because they're so very far apart in years, 74 and 27.
Those air races were interesting because, again, this is 1927. It's not like there are pilots on every street corner. This is a new industry. This is a burgeoning field. I mean, the Wright brothers made their historic flight in what year?
1903.
So this is less than 30 years of evolution. I mean, here we are 30 years out from the invention of the internet, roughly.
Yeah.
And look how far it's come, right? And how many people are involved. These air races, they drew a crowd, I would imagine.
98,000 plus. They didn't have enough bleachers. They didn't have enough seating, food, places for people to stay. I mean, it fascinated the American public, flight. And there was money to be won as well.
Georgia, tell me some of the things that you know to be true about Nick as a family man. Was he more obsessed with his flying than he was?
I think he was more obsessed with his flying than being a family man. Yeah. And I just think that he was a happy guy. I mean, you know, he was doing what he loved to do.
That much is obvious,
and,
for sure.
You know, he had a family, but flying was his life. And being a daredevil was his life, more so than being a family man. But I don't know for sure either. You know, it's just kind of what I kind of remember. I was 8 years old when my grandmother died. So, you know, it's kind of hard for me to remember. And we didn't talk about Nick. As a little girl, I don't remember talking about Nick. It wasn't until we were older that we asked her questions, and my dad and my mom talked about him.
As you learned about Nick and what he did and who he was growing up with your parents and hearing stories, what were some of the first impressions that you had of him?
Just proud of him and what he did as a young man and how he advanced aviation, and that we just all, my two brothers and I, we just wished that we had known him. That, kind of a hero thing now. But, you know, when we were little, we would come over to Spokane. We had relatives here, and we'd always go to the field, and we'd always go to the clock and have our picture taken and have breakfast there at the restaurant and look at the pictures. And, you know, it was always something that we always did. He was a part of us, but not a part of us.
Jane, tell me about some of the other items, artifacts, collection pieces that you have here in the museum related to Nick.
Oh, let me show you something. This is a piece of wing fabric. Oh. And this came to us from a gal in North Carolina because she saw that your family had donated Nick's personal collection of his aviation career. So she called and she said, I understand you have Nick Mamer's collection. My grandmother was in Osborne when Nick crashed his plane. It wasn't a bad crash, just kind of. To make a long story short, that's a piece of his wing.
Oh.
He also, these are Nick's letters that you're aware of, that or notes that he would drop in a bag with rocks so that the, you know, the for the different airfields and so on.
Yeah.
if I could, for the radio listeners who can't see this fantastic piece of history that I hold in my hand right now, I'd like to read it. The first item is a piece of fabric. It looks a bit like linen.
It is linen. It's Irish linen.
There you go. And it has upon it written, August 23rd, 1920, Lieutenant Mamer's plane wrecked at Osborne. And that's Osborne...
North Idaho.
And it is browned with age. There's some glue on the back showing where it might have been attached to the frame. And it's about, I'd say, 8 inches by 8 inches. Fascinating piece. Of history there. And the other piece of history that I'm holding is one of the notes that Nick would drop in advance of coming up to a city so he could get fuel.
He'd circle the airfield and drop those. Those letters are fascinating in terms of, you know, what they needed, of course, gasoline and oil, but what they requested to eat.
Right.
Yeah, the food.
Fried chicken, tomato juice, right. Let's have a couple pies.
Uh-huh. How do you get a pie from one plane to another in the sky? I mean, that gives a whole new definition to the term pie in the sky, right?
Drop things on ropes.
So let's talk about that in just a sec. Step one was that Nick and Art Walker would drop these notes from their planes while circling an airfield. And this particular note has on it typed, so I assume that was all prepared before they left.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't take a typewriter up with them.
No.
Okay. It says, Dear Sir, will you kindly deliver this message to all news services in your city, thereby accommodating Spokane Sun God? Nick Mamer. And then handwritten, it says, Dear Captain Hawks, we have been up over 50 or 60 hours. And you can appreciate that we have, I can't read what that says.
We have not misused our whirlwind, the right whirlwind. That was the engine pulling an overload of around 800 pounds. They were overloaded because of all that extra gas. Uh-huh. It's a miracle that that plane even got off the ground.
Okay. Pulling an overload of around 800 pounds from Spokane to Frisco and east over the hump to Cheyenne is no slight task for even our empty ship. You got to imagine, it's not like your comfortable, Delta 737 flight over the United States back in 1929. It's a bumpy ride. And he's writing in cursive, and I'm trying to read that now, almost 100 years later.
And it was so crowded. Mm-hmm. There was at one point when him and Art were going to change places to do something, they kind of got stuck.
Right.
Because they remodeled the plane to add a 200-gallon tank.
Right.
Inside, took out the passenger seating, mm-hmm. and they were just, elbows and...
Yeah, because one had to sleep and the other one had to pilot it.
It just.
And wouldn't it be nice if we could find it?
You know, you bring up an interesting point.
It's been searched for.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that for a minute. Mm-hmm. What have you heard about where it might have ended up?
I don't know. I haven't heard anything. I just know that when they were writing the book, that the question was, where is the plane?
This is J.B. Rivard's book.
Mm-hmm.
High on Sky, High on Gas, Low on Gas. Sky. High on,
Low on sky.
Yeah.
High on sky, low on gas.
Yeah. That's a little bit of a tongue twister.
I know. And we were trying to figure out where the plane might have been or looking through. He came over to Whidbey Island to my brother's house and went through things to gather information to write the book.
Right.
And I don't think in there was anything mm-hmm. about what happened to the sun god.
It's the biggest mystery, and boy, if it's ever found,
uh-huh.
it's amazing because there are so many aircraft that are still on display mm-hmm. from all of the famous aviators and so on. And the last time it was seen was about, I think it was 1931 or 32 at an air show. But it had been specifically painted red and white for Buell air sedan for the flight. But then when they were done, the paint was taken off because when you see it, there's a photo of it in that 1931 mm-hmm. 31 or 32. It doesn't look like the sun god. It just looks like any Buell air sedan just mm-hmm. sitting there. So, and many people, there are actually several people, local people who searched for a long time. Mm-hmm. Hard to know what happened. You know, Buell went bankrupt, the company. And sometimes when I say Buell, I think I'm talking about Buell Felds. But the company went bankrupt, and some people think, well, maybe it was just sold off, because they did sell off some of their aircraft. So,
but what happened to it after Nick flew? Did he sell it? Did it go back to
Buell? It went back to the company.
It went back to the company because it wasn't owned by anybody.
Right.
Okay.
They lent it for the Sun God flight.
So let's talk about that for just a quick second. The something that nobody had done before on a continual basis to show that it could be done was Nick and Art flying from one side of the country to another, and to refuel without landing, he would get another pilot to match his speed and approach from above, mere feet, and lower down a milk can full of airplane fuel, where Art would then have to try to grab it out of the air and then bring it into the plane and empty it by, you know, upending it into the giant tank that they had.
That was one time.
It's a garden hose.
Yeah.
And the rest of the times, there would be a tank of gas on this other plane, and they would just run a hose down.
A garden
and then,
hose. Okay. Yeah.
And then somehow the...
They would grab it in the air.
Gravity flow it down to the
tank below.
It's
amazing Art didn't get sucked right out of that plane.
I know.
He stood out in the 90 mile an hour trying to grab this hose. He got doused with gasoline.
I'm sure he did.
A couple of times.
I'm sure he did. Did Nick Mamer have a company at Felts Field? Did he have a business? Tell me about that.
Numerous businesses. Mm-hmm. Mamer Air Transport, Mamer Flying School, Mamer School of Flying. Let's see, what did he call the company when he bought the two Ford Tri-Motors?
It was Schreck. Schreck
yeah,
was
eventually
in there,
Mamer
too.
Schreck.
Yeah, Mamer Schreck.
We kind of leave Schreck out of the picture here.
Yeah.
Let's bring Schreck into the picture for just a few seconds. Who was that? What's his name?
Roy Schreck.
Mm-hmm. What was his role in relationship with Nick Mamer?
Well, they were partners for a time period.
Business partners.
Yes, Mamer Schreck. I have heard he had a very large ego.
Yes.
There wasn't room in the airplane for Schreck, his ego, and another, say, co-pilot. That's what's been said in some of the archives.
Yeah, some of the archives, yeah.
What else do you want to say about Nick Mamer and the impact that he had on Spokane and on the two of you?
Well, to answer the first question, you cannot study, learn about Spokane in this area without learning about Nick. Mm-hmm. And I personally, in looking at researching, coming to understand the things that he did in terms of pushing the envelope, developed an admiration and ended up calling him Nicky B. I just felt like I know this guy so well, and I don't mean any offense at all. No. There are a number of aviators in the valley who were around at the time of Nick who also lost their lives pushing the envelope, trying new things. But they didn't do the things that Nick did. Participate in the 1927 air races, the 1929 in-flight refueling, the distance. I just feel like I've gotten to know him.
I would just say that for me, he was a grandfather that I never knew. I grew up knowing about him and just reading about his adventures and what he did and how he kind of started different things in the Spokane area and what a daredevil he was. Makes me proud that I'm his granddaughter and that I just really wish that I had met him.
I think that's true for all three of us. Well, thank you so much for spending the time today. Georgia Ferris, granddaughter of Nick Mamer and Jane Singleton, director of the Spokane Valley Heritage Museum. Thank you both for your time. It's been a fascinating conversation.
Thank you very much for having us.
And as a reminder, visitors to Spokane's Felts Field today can see the enormous concrete Art Deco clock that was dedicated to Nick Mamer's memory in 1939, a year after his death. Thousands attended the dedication ceremony to mourn their local hero and commemorate his life with the installation of the clock. In 2020, the airport undertook a restoration of the historic clock, which involved cleaning the concrete and brass surfaces, as well as replacing the lights on the inside of the tower to illuminate the red circle hour indicators. If you're not in Spokane, you can see some amazing pictures of the Mamer clock at the Washington Hour Home social media feeds on Facebook, Instagram, and X. Time to answer those nagging trivia questions I know you've been waiting for. Question one was, what type of airplane did Mamer and Walker use to set the long-distance record in 1929? The answers were A, Fokker C-2, B, J-5 Eagle Rock, C, Lockheed 14, or D, Buell CA-6. The correct answer, of course, is D, the Buell CA-6 Sesquiplane. The Fokker C-2 ? Set the original flight endurance record in January of 1929 by remaining in the air for more than 150 hours. The J-5 Eagle Rock biplane was used to deliver fuel to the sun god in milk canisters over Miles City, Montana. And the Lockheed 14 Super Electra was the plane Mamer was piloting when he crashed and died in January 1938. Question two was, how did stuntman Wesley May prove that aerial refueling was possible when he did it in 1921? The answers were A, parachuting onto a moving plane, which is ridiculous, B, descending from another aircraft using a rope ladder, which I suppose would have been possible, C, walking across the wing of his own aircraft to the wing of another with a gas can strapped to his back, or D, picking up full gas cans at 90 miles per hour while flying low across the ground, which is probably just plain suicidal. No, the correct answer is C. He walked from one plane's wing to another in mid-flight to bring a gas can to the second plane. Question three, which food item was not delivered to Mamer and Walker in mid-flight? Your answers were A, watermelon, B, pie, C, ice cream, and D, fettuccine Alfredo. While each of these items also seems like they would be extraordinarily difficult to deliver to a 90-mile-per-hour biplane, the creamy pasta dish would likely have been a little too messy for air travel. The correct answer was D. Question four, what color was the Spokane sun god? Red, blue, brown, or gray? The answer, of course, is a brilliant, bright red. And question five, into which river did the Spokane sun god drop the empty milk cans that were used to refuel the plane over Montana? Your answers were A, the Missouri River, B, the Yellowstone River, C, the Clark Fork River, and D, the Flathead River. After each of the three refueling operations, Mamer flew over the B, Yellowstone River, and Walker tossed the empty cans into the water, where a boy in a rowboat waited at the nearby bridge to get the cans out and bring them back to the refueling crew. That's it for today's episode of Washington Hour Home. A big, big thanks to Jane Singleton, Georgia Ferris, and the Spokane Valley Heritage Museum for their contributions. Also thanks to the HistoryNet, Aerofiles, and Spokane Historical websites. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast for new episodes. Leave me a 5-star review if you're so inclined. And maybe visit patreon.com/WashingtonHourHome to help keep the show going. Follow me on Facebook, X, Instagram, and YouTube. And until next month, I'm your fearless field guide, Eric Ebel, and I'll see you somewhere in Washington.